Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Back in the 1970s, federal lawmakers set out to write the law that finally, in theory, would make the education of children with disabilities a priority in the nation's school districts. Even then, despite the idealism of the time, some experts argued that the process conceived in Washington would fall short along the fault lines, again, of poverty and race across the United States. OSU law professor Ruth Kolker, a leading scholar of constitutional law and disability discrimination, learned that even with her financial and educational resources, advocating for her own child was the most stressful time of her life. In her new book, Disabled Education, Ruth Kolker says that the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act has fallen short, in part by relying on parents to act as advocates for their children in a highly subjective classification system. Ruth has written 12 books. She's widely published in all the most prestigious law reviews. In 2009, she was designated a distinguished university professor, OSU's highest academic honor. She's with us today in the studio. Welcome back, Ruth.
Well, thanks, Anne. Great to be here.
Question for our listeners first, because we'd like you to join the conversation. We would like to hear from you, teachers, parents, anyone who has grappled with the Individuals with Education Act. Tell us your stories about how it has worked or not in your own experience. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ruth Kolker, when the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act was written in the mid-1970s, it was not only named something else, but I was wondering, were there actual caveats to its implementation, such as if the school district can afford it, or if the evaluators properly diagnose and understand a child's disability, or if the parents are smart enough, sophisticated enough, and rich enough to advocate for their child? You know, were those kind of caveats written into it? Did people understand that may need to be?
Well, the statute itself, when it was enacted in 1975, was at that time called the Education for All Handicapped Children Act. And the addition of the word all was a huge development, because before then, children like my great-great uncle, who were born mentally retarded, or what today we would call intellectually disabled, never spent a day in a classroom. And you're probably about my age. We didn't have children in the classroom we went to school who had significant disabilities. So the statute in 1975 made a huge promise, and Congress promised in 75 that it would fund 40% of the local school district's expenses in educating these children. That hasn't ever happened. But there were huge, huge promises made in 1975. Were there skeptics? Were there cynics? Of course there were. But that's the promise Congress made, which is an astonishing promise. I just wish it had been kept.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what's commonly known as special education and how the system works in the United States. And we'll get more specific later on with Ohio. Ruth Kolker, you mentioned at the outset of the book that there was a leading researcher and activist in special education who warned them then that the proposed law would do more harm than good. He predicted that the special education system would fall into the same poverty traps, and that's my phrase, as the rest of public education. Why do you think he was ignored, or what was he seeing then that others didn't?
And that was the most astonishing finding when I was researching the book. Lloyd Dunn is someone who, if people have a background in special education, they would have read Lloyd Dunn's work. He wrote the first major study where he found that children with cognitive impairments, what today we would call mental retardation, could be mainstream, put in a regular classroom, and make really significant educational progress with appropriate supports. So his work was crucial to Congress and others thinking we should have a special education law. But even so, he was terribly critical of the law that was eventually enacted, because he felt that they were naive and not understanding the kinds of supports and assistance that many children would need. They took a very isolated study of a small group of individuals with very moderate intellectual disabilities and generalized to the entire disability population. And as you probably know, if you've done any work or reading in this field, children with disabilities vary so much. We can't have a one-size-fits-all package that works for all of them. Why he was ignored, I don't know. No one before me that I know of realizes that he even testified against the enactment of the statute. That was one of the neat historical discoveries I made in researching for this book.
You already were an expert in the field of special education, but it was your own experience, I gather, that inspired this book. Tell us about that. Tell us about, you write about it pretty openly about your own child and what you went through.
Yeah, I do. My son is now 16 and doing great, but I got a rude introduction into the special education system when my son was in fourth grade, and he had been classified as disabled. He had struggled as a youngster, had received great help from the school system when he was quite young, and I was really thrilled with that. But when my son was in fourth grade, the audiologist that I was working with recommended that he needed what they call a personal listening device that would allow him to hear classroom instruction directly from the teacher by wearing sort of a hearing aid in one ear. It's not exactly hearing aid, but it's similar to that kind of technology. And it was the recommendation of my audiologist, who was the school district's own audiologist. He was scoring in the second percentile. It was in a subtle case. And for reasons that I still don't understand, they just said no, even though their own data showed that this was something he crucially needed. And so, unfortunately, I had to sue them, and we could discuss what that process is like. And I did prevail, and starting in sixth grade, he got the help he needed, and I'm really proud of him. I mean, in ninth grade, he took some standardized tests and just killed the curve. So he learned tremendously, but he had to be able to hear classroom instruction to learn, and he wasn't able to access classroom instruction until they gave them a rather inexpensive assistive technology in the classroom.
The reason that I thought it was interesting, it's a little thing, but it's a big thing. The reason why you even knew about this technology was because of your own work with the audiologist. It wasn't because the district sent your child to that audiologist. It was from working with that audiologist, talking to him about your situations and saying, maybe he ought to be tested for this.
You're absolutely right, Ann. I was teaching my special education class, and I bring in outside medical experts to help my students better understand the medical aspects of disability. That's important. And I had Gail Whitelaw, who's the director of OSU's Speech and Hearing Clinic, come into my class. She's the former past president of the American Audiological Association, so one of the nation's experts in audiology, a wonderful person. And she comes in, she talks to my students, and afterwards we're just chatting. And I say, you know, my son's just having this problem accessing classroom communication. I don't know what's going on. His grades are slipping. He's all of a sudden not doing well. She said, I think you should bring him in to have his hearing tested. I'd like to test him. And she tested him, and I was shocked with the results. I had no idea. And so, yeah, if it wasn't because of my work and expertise, I never even had heard of the condition that he has. I never would have thought to have him tested. And the school district itself would not have either.
And the system was not set up to be so relationship-oriented. It was set up to just work without having to know somebody. Or at least that was the idea.
Right. We say that each child is entitled to a free, appropriate, public education. And free is the first of those four words. What that means is that a child is supposed to be tested and evaluated by the school district. They do the testing for free, not at any cost to the parent. The education is supposed to be appropriate. So in my son's case, he truly couldn't access oral communication in the classroom. And I argued that it was inappropriate for him to sit there looking at the clock all day because he couldn't access oral communication. It's supposed to be public. It is supposed to be meaningful education. And so the hearing officer concluded that he was not receiving an appropriate education if he couldn't access classroom communication.
Finally, part of the problem might have been that the device cost $1,000?
Well, I don't know. $1,000 to me is a pretty small price for a child. He started with this device in sixth grade. He'll be in the system through 12th. There's some repair expenses they have from time to time. When you compare that with the cost of individualized instruction, special education teachers, they were willing to give him an individualized instruction in special education, which is much more expensive, ultimately, than this device.
Which brings up a question, and this may not fit into the conversation or not, but it did make me wonder whether or not the school districts are leaders in developing new technologies for teaching, or if the districts are followers and tend to go with what's proven and what's more well-known.
Yeah, I don't think this is a new device. But my experience, I've volunteered on a pro bono basis to help dozens of other children. And, you know, after I helped my own son, I was like, okay, I got to help some other people. This isn't fair to just help him. And what I tend to find is the school districts, they have their programs. You know, this is our program for kids with ADHD. This is our program for kids with learning disabilities. This is our, you know, and my son's needs didn't fit one of their programs. Now, the statute says you're supposed to get an individualized educational program, not a cookie cutter. And so I think that for convenience or resources or whatever, school districts don't necessarily do what the statute says, create an individualized program.
But the statute, as you mentioned earlier, doesn't do what the statute said, which is adequately fund districts to achieve these goals.
That's right. School funding in Ohio is really complicated, and I can't describe it.
I'm sorry. Did I bring up school funding in Ohio? I don't want to talk about that.
Right. But I think that it's fair to say that school districts get less than 17% of the money that they need to educate children with disabilities. And depending on the district, it could be much less than that.
Let's just talk, let's get started about the idea of the expectation. And it's part of the law's intent, or it's written into the law somehow, that a parent act as an advocate for his or her child. Was that part of the original law? What does it mean? And I'm glad I've never had to do that.
Yeah, that was a real eye-opener for me. What the statute says is that first the school district needs to identify who might be disabled, and we call that child find. So let's assume for a moment that works perfectly. Then after the child has been classified as disabled, there's a meeting called the Individualized Education Program with the parent as a part of, the school district personnel as a part of, and they sit around the table, and typically 8-9 school district people are there without name tags or anything, and the parent. And you collaboratively are supposed to develop a plan that's individualized for that child. And the school district would probably be shocked to hear this, but even I'm intimidated. And, you know, I'm never intimidated. But even I'm intimidated sitting in a room with 8 people, and I don't even know what they do. Who's the speech and language pathologist? Who's the principal? Who's, you know, I work full time. I'm not in the PTO. I don't know who these people are. And so they're supposed to sit around collaboratively and devise a plan. Not surprisingly, there's empirical evidence that when a parent is like me and is middle class and well-educated, their kid gets a lot more resources because the parent knows how to be an effective advocate. But even I find it hard to be an effective advocate. It's very challenging.
I have sat in on those meetings, and it's sort of like a star chamber. The first thing they do is ask the parent, well, tell us about your child.
Right. They always start with your vision statement. And that's very nice. It feels good. It's not legally enforceable. But when we get into the nuts and bolts of how to write an individualized education program, I mean, what parent knows how to request 30 minutes of speech and language pathology to work on the TH sound and the F sound, you know, for 3 months, and then we'll move on to, that's what these programs are supposed to look like. Very specific, very individualized. And there are very few parents who would know a good program from a bad program because we don't have that kind of training and expertise.
I'm talking with Ruth Kolker. She's the author of a new book. It's called Disabled Education, A Critical Analysis of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. You maybe heard the word critical in there, which should be noted that we did invite a representative of the Ohio Department of Education to join us for the hour. For their point of view, they declined last week, saying that they were unable to provide us the appropriate spokesperson with such short notice. Once again, listeners, we would like to hear from you, teachers and parents, others who have grappled with the Individuals with Education Act. Tell us your stories about how it worked or not in your experience. Ruth Kolker is critical of how the act has worked. Maybe you disagree with that. We'd like to hear from you as well. 614-292-8513 is the number. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. That is a quick and efficient way to communicate with us these days. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Special education in the United States was recalibrated in the mid-1970s with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. A fundamental piece of the law was the expectations that parents would act as advocates for their children. I'm talking with one such parent this hour, OSU Law Professor Ruth Kolker, a leading scholar of constitutional law and disability discrimination and the author of a new book called Disabled Education, A Critical Analysis of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Ruth, let's talk about what's, you know, we had predictions from Professor Dunn or Dr. Dunn at the time back in the 70s and the late 60s and early 70s when they were debating this bill. One of the things he predicted was there would be a gap in coverage, but and it would fall along the usual poverty lines, which means it would fall along racial lines as well. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about that? Because it's not necessarily something denoted when it's being considered in that process.
Yes, it's really a shame that he was right. I wish I could have said that he was wrong. But he predicted we'd see racial and class-based disproportionality, as we had seen before there were such laws, because remember the 1960s, we just had blatant racial segregation in the United States in our school systems, and he was concerned that the special education laws would be a backdoor way to reintroduce racial segregation. And unfortunately, that has often happened. So if we think about the classification system itself, children have to be in one of 10 disability categories to be covered by the statute, and the resources they get very much are affected by which disability category they're in. And so one of the things I note in the book is the racial disproportionality we see in those classifications. So let me just give you a couple of quick examples. African-American children are labeled what we call emotionally disturbed, which is sort of the category parents probably least want their child to receive. They're labeled emotionally disturbed twice their rate in the population. So they're about 14% of all school-age children, but they're 28% of those children in special ed labeled as emotionally disturbed. White children are less likely to be labeled emotionally disturbed than their existence in the population. Similarly, African-American children are disproportionately likely to be classified as what the statute calls mentally retarded. Again, more than twice their rate in the population, 32.5%. Whites are below their statistics in the population. By contrast, autism is a category that children often get very intensive one-on-one, very effective resources. African-American children are very unlikely to find themselves in the autism category. White children are very likely to be in the autism category. I can't believe there's some genetic DNA explanation for these different results. What I think we see is that the same child with the same behaviors, if they're African-American boy, they're called emotionally disturbed. If they're a white boy, they're called autistic with much of the same behavior. It's really important because your classification affects the services you receive. And receiving one-on-one applied behavioral therapy, which is what we try to give children with autism, is very different than being put in a classroom for children who are emotionally disturbed, where you're basically a cattle car.
And then there's a couple issues there. Why, assuming the child is emotionally disabled or disturbed or whatever tag you want to give that, why is it that they're put into something equivalent to a cattle car? Why is that not given the same sort of priority as somebody who is autistic?
Well, Eloise Pasikoff, who's a professor at Georgetown, has done some really important, helpful work. And what she has essentially argued is if you look at the way the political system operates, so the parents with resources like me, middle-class white parents, they're able to influence public policy and have resources go to those things they want for their child, right? So there's been a huge push to have increased autism funding. Now, I agree we should have, of course, the best education possible for children with autism. I don't mean to suggest otherwise. But it has been white middle-class parents who really pushed that issue and then pushed the idea that their children fall into that classification.
And you're saying that it's at the expense of others whose fall into categories that can be...
I guess we could think of it that way. There's only so many dollars in the pie.
Right.
So obviously that's not what they intended. I don't want to in any way suggest that we should blame them for being effective.
Right.
But we don't have a similar lobby for children who are labeled emotionally disturbed. Now, just one other category I want to mention, which is crucially important, is that Latino children are very, very unlikely to be identified during preschool as being disabled.
Unlikely.
Mm-hmm. And we think of the 3 to 5 year old age group as being the most crucial time in a child's life for brain development, education. And so when my child was identified at age 3 and got 2 years of intensive programming that Franklin County offered, that's probably the 2 most important years of his life. And other parents would say the same thing. Latino children are extremely unlikely to receive that extra 2 years of specialized education. So again, that's a different feeling. We have the programs, but we're not reaching those parents and those children to locate and find them.
And do we know why that's happening?
Well, some people think that there's socio-cultural language barriers. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of, you know, problems there. But a school district, a state, has an obligation to reach out to children, even in their preschool years, and we find they fall short when it comes to reaching Latino children.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. You wanted to talk about the lack of resources. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi. I taught special ed for 30 years, and I taught the really severely handicapped ones now. But boy, when you're talking about children with physical needs, maybe severe mental illness, self-injurious behavior like headbanging and all this kind of stuff, and aggressive behavior, boy, especially when they get larger and they can get over a couple of 100 pounds, we're talking about what we would really need is 2 or 3 people per student. But those resources just are not available. When Congress passed the original law, 94-142, it was an unfunded mandate. Well, the states will do this and we'll give them some money. Well, the money never really came, just a fraction. I forget what percent. I think it's under 10% of the total. And the rest is left up to the states and the cities. They're already stretched for resources. And then to have, in many cases, 1-to-1 or even 2-to-1, 3-to-1 teachers per student, again, for someone who's large and medical problems and aggression against others or self, the money's just not there.
Okay, Mike, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about special education as it was conceived back in the mid-70s with the with a law that Mike just suggested maybe is outdated, but Ruth Kolker, you're saying it was never funded properly in the first place, and now it's at 17% of what it should be.
At best.
I
mean, you know, those are hard data to calculate. But I think there's another point we should all remember, is that it's priceless to be educating these children. Children with disabilities have very high high school dropout rates. They have low prospects for later employment. One of the things the statute emphasizes appropriately is the importance of independent living, of people receiving the education necessary so they can live independently and be productive members of society. And education works. We know it works. It's working right now for a lot of middle-class white children. And we need to spread that much further to have it work for a lot more children, because we as a society will ultimately benefit if these students can become productive members of our society by being appropriately educated.
Ben in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ben. Hello, Ben.
My name is Ben, and I want to talk a little bit about my daughter.
Okay.
My daughter has a couple of learning disorders, a language processing disorder, and a sequencing disorder, which makes math really difficult for her. And we had her in a very affluent, one of the most fluent suburban school districts, and the school didn't want to do testing. We had to, you know, write a letter and say, you have to do the testing. And then their attitude was pretty much, like, she's not a very smart child. She's kind of dim because her IQ came out in the low average range, which if you have a language processing disorder, it affects every part of your IQ test. And they just didn't really want to do anything with her. And they treated her like a stupid child, and like we were parents of a stupid child. And she went from being an outgoing kid that was always getting into trouble and bright and fun to a kid that was like, I can't do this, I can't do that, I'm not smart enough. It had a huge effect on how she looked at herself. And, you know, we pulled her from the school system, and we were living in this expensive school district paying the school taxes and put her in a private school where they were able to to meet her needs, because we just felt it was going to be a huge uphill battle to get them to provide the services that she needed. And then the private school, they were able to provide the accommodations that she needed without making, we didn't have to have a formalized plan. They just made the accommodations that she needed, and she really thrived there. But, you know, she's really lucky. You're talking about socioeconomic things. I mean, now she's a high school student. She's getting A's and B's. She's passed her OGTs the first time out. I mean, she's doing amazingly well, given what we were told. We were told all along, you have to lower your expectations. You can't expect a lot from this child. She won't be able to do a lot. And she's doing great. So, I mean, I just think, you know, it's a really uphill battle to get the kids the services that they need. And, you know, our daughter got the services that she needed because we were able to, you know, we were able to afford it. We were able to put her in that, right, in those programs. And the other thing I think it's important is not to, as a parent, it can be very difficult not to just give up on them, because I did to some extent lower my expectations for what she was going to be capable of doing. And every time I've done that, she's far surpassed what I thought she was, what I was told and what I believed she was capable of doing. Mm-hmm. So you just don't know with these kids in the third or fourth grade what they're going to be like in high school.
Thanks, Ben, for your call. We really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ben brought up something I wanted to get back at. The district has an obligation to do testing. But if the parent disagrees with what the tests come up with, if they're the, you know, in Ben's case, they didn't even want to do that. But if they do that, the parent has to pay for that themselves for independent testing.
It depends.
Okay.
The statute provides the option for a parent to get what's called an independent educational evaluation at public expense. So in Ben's case, I, of course, don't know anything about his particular situation, but in Ben's case, if his school district did inadequate and inappropriate testing, let's say they didn't even bother to test the math sequencing problem, then he could request to the school district that he be allowed to provide his own testing that they would pay for. The school district has to respond to that request, and if they disagree, there can be due process hearing about that request. So technically, the statute does provide that when the school district's testing is inadequate, the parent can get free testing. But I always encourage parents, if they have a health care plan and they have health insurance, go ahead and get the testing that your plan provides, because then you, of course, have the choice of providers and experts. And, of course, that's obviously what I did in my case. The school district doesn't have the kind of technology needed to do an appropriate audiology exam. And so when my child went to OSU Speech and Hearing Center, where they have the special rooms, you know, set up for that, then we could get the testing he needed.
The district doesn't have the technology, but they contract out for the technology, don't they?
They could contract out for the technology. I had not asked him to do that particular test. I didn't know that test existed.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, it was really only, as I said, and my health insurance plan covered it. So for the $35 copay, it made sense for me to just go down that route.
Matthew in Columbus, you're on the air. You wanted to talk about how parents are differently equipped sometimes to cope with the process. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Thank you very much. My wife works in this field, and I get to listen to these comments at the dinner table every evening. So from the experiences I hear, there's a whole other side of the coin, and I agree with everything that's been said here to this point, but let's look at the other end of the spectrum for a moment and look at the parents who, if you provide, like, say, a speech plan where they're going to work on THs, but the parents at home don't even have good speech and refuse to even try with their kid to have good speech, they're the same parents who don't help their kids with their homework. All those things happen too, and you have kids that are in speech for 4 years, and there's no improvement because they don't do any practice. So what do you do with that kid when they get into the 8th or 10th grade, when they are not making any effort to make progress?
Okay, so...
And then, secondly, there are a number of other parents who come in and they try to get their kid in special ed, when they're perfectly normal, when they have perfectly good IQs and whatnot, but they've heard that the kid down the street is collecting Social Security check because he's got some disability, and these kids are trying to get into the system. Their parents are trying to push them into the system,
okay,
to get more entitlements.
All right. Matthew, that's not what I expected you to talk about. Those are two different issues I wasn't expecting. So first of all, what about that home help and whether or not parents are necessarily equipped to fill that role?
Well, you know, the statute provides that each child should get a free, appropriate public education. And it's great that a lot of parents help out and I help out, but not all children are fortunate enough to be in that situation. And I think that the school district needs to understand that and not write educational plans that put the onus on the parents. I follow all the complaints filed against Ohio school districts, and I read some of these IEPs that the state investigators find are unlawful. And some of these plans will say things like, parent will work nightly with child to help their organizational skills. Mm-hmm. And doesn't say anything about what the school district will do. Now, I understand that Michael, I think was his name, was not talking about that situation. But school districts need to understand that the onus is on them to be providing this education. It is not on the parents, and not all children are fortunate enough to be in families where the parents have the capacity to assist. Some children, of course, have genetic-based disabilities, and their parents have the same disabilities. That's not the child's fault, and we should give that child an appropriate education irrespective of their parents' resources.
There's always going to be people trying to scam a system. As wherever there's a system that exists, someone's out there trying to scam the system. But what about people who are working? I wanted to get more into the socioeconomic issue of people who are working three jobs, people who are single parents, people who don't have the sophistication necessarily, the education that you did, Ruth Kolker. You said it was the most stressful time in your life. So what about somebody who's working three jobs and has an issue? What about them?
Oh, no, and I agree. I mean, I am a single parent, and I know what it's like to work full-time and come home and prepare dinner and sit down with the kids and try to help them with homework. But I can't even begin to imagine what it would be like if I didn't have a flexible job as a law professor where I don't work, you know, as long a day in the office as many other parents. My heart goes out to parents. I work with a lot of parents who are poor and are single and are struggling, and I have never yet met a bad parent. You know, the fact that they call me itself indicates that they're a really good parent, but it doesn't mean they have the time and the resources to be their child's educator. That's why we have a school system.
There was a story that you told, a case you wrote about briefly, about how the investigator in the case, that's not the right word you use, but the person who hears the case,
the hearing officer
was doing bending over backwards, I think was your phrase, to help this woman negotiate the system. But no matter what, even the hearing officer's hands were tied unless the parent put forth the right proof, she couldn't get what she wanted or what she really truly believed her child needed.
Yeah, I think that's the opening story I tell in the book, that this woman, you know, files a complaint against her school district. I've never met her. I only know her through, you know, the transcript from the case. She does the right thing. She files a complaint. Her brother comes to the hearings with her to help a little bit. She's pregnant herself with another child. She has some health issues during this hearing. She doesn't know how to write a brief and put on testimony. She tries calling the hearing officer and leaving voicemail messages. You know, a totally inappropriate way to use the system, but the only thing she knew how to do. Now, what I argue in the book is that parents like her should have a lay advocate who's with them, that it's unreasonable to expect parents, all parents, to be an advocate for their child. I think that these meetings would go better. They would be more professional. They would achieve better outcomes if instead of spending so much money on hearing officers and other kinds of things, we devoted some of those resources to providing lay advocates for each of these parents who don't have the financial resources to hire a lawyer on their own. Our children deserve that, I think.
Matthew, thanks again for that call. We will return to our conversation, get a little more focused on Ohio's laws and how they work when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the federal law that provides special education services for for children from infants to, I think, 21 years old. Still with us is OSU Law Professor Ruth Kolker, author of a new book that analyzes the system. It's called Disabled Education. Joining us now, Kristen Hildebrandt. She's a senior attorney at Disability Rights Ohio, Ohio's protection and advocacy agency for people with disabilities. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne.
Once again, want to let people know that we did invite a representative of the Ohio Department of Education to join us for the hour. They declined last week, saying that they were unable to help us out with the appropriate spokesperson with such short notice. So once again, listeners, we're going to like to hear from you. If you have grappled with the Individuals with Education Act, tell us your stories about how it worked or not in your experience. 614-292-8513. Let's talk about Ohio. Ruth, you've called Ohio's two-step hearing officer process cumbersome. That's your word. Two steps sound easy. What's the problem?
It's an endurance contest.
Okay.
One of the things the statute does, in theory, is it tries to give the child quick relief, because a year of lost education in a system where you only get 12 years of education is huge. We don't want that to happen. And so the statute has all these rules that after you file a complaint, you know, you used to have a hearing within like 30 days and a decision by 45 more days. So that's sort of in about 3 months, this process should be from finish to end. As I'm sure Kristen can agree, I've never seen a process that lasted the specified time. And so what happens is, so in my case, I filed our complaint maybe in May. We got a decision by September, because I kept saying, no delays, no delays, no delays. If they had appealed it, it would have been another probably 6 months before my son would have gotten the assistive listening device he needed. I was arguing based on data we collected in fourth grade. He was in sixth grade when we got relief. He would have been in seventh grade had there been an appeal. Can you imagine losing 3 years of education at that time?
Well, at that time, losing 6 months of education, losing 3 months of education. Kristen Hildebrandt, I mean, every day counts.
Every day does count. And the due process system, I think when Congress passed the law in 1975, was supposed to be an easy process for parents to navigate. And over the years, it's become very difficult for them. And it's gotten to the point where there are always lawyers representing school districts, and it's a hard thing for parents to navigate, especially if they can't find an attorney to assist them through the process.
You said over the years. So things have changed then.
From my perspective, they have. I've been doing this for 24 years, and when I was new to this and was going through due process hearings, they seemed to be a simpler process that occurred in a more timely fashion. They've become very legalized, because parents are typically the ones requesting the hearing, they have the burden of proving their case. And in order to do that in the current system, it requires pretty extensive testimony and witnesses and long periods of time. We've been involved in a hearing recently where there were approximately 20 briefs and motions that were filed before the hearing ever started. So you can imagine if a parent doesn't have representation through that process, how lost they would be.
Ruth Kolker, you wrote about the Winkleman case in which the Ohio school district's litigation costs exceeded the cost of the private school education sought by the parents. Why do districts do that?
Well, I don't know. You should, I guess,
I mean,
ask
I guess
them.
Ask them, but what's your sense about why they're going through this? Isn't it as tedious for them as it is for the individuals?
Well, they usually have an insurance policy.
Okay.
So they're not going to cover their legal fees once they pay their deductible. And, you know, there's the problem of if word gets out that they are sending Sandy Winkleman's son to this special school for children with autism, how many other parents are going to come forward and make that request? I guess they could think of it as a slippery slope.
Kristen, what are your thoughts about it?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons why school districts do that. One is that they don't want to set precedent, particularly if it's an expensive service or item that a parent is requesting. Ruth talked earlier about specific services for children with autism. And if a parent asks for ABA services for their child, you can pretty much bet that the school district is going to fight as far as they need to go not to have to provide that service, because then other parents will start asking for it, and it's expensive. I think also there's this trend in special education of blame the parent. And I think Ruth talks about that when she reviewed the due process decisions. Frequently, hearing officers will document that the parents were difficult to work with or brought this on somehow themselves. So there is that kind of feeling that I get when I represent families, that there's a personal issue between the school district and the families. And for some reason, the district feels justified in fighting as hard as they can because the parent, they perceive the parent to be difficult to work with.
Is there any sense, Ruth Kolker, of how many kids are out there that aren't getting served appropriately because of the way the system's been put in place since 1975 to, you know, provide appropriate education for all children?
Well, that's a really hard question. One thing I do document in the book is that, unfortunately, since Congress changed the definition of what it means to be learning disabled in 2004, supposedly to make it easier to be classified as learning disabled, to get rid of some of the socioeconomic bias, we're seeing on an absolute level fewer children classified as learning disabled. So we're seeing a downward trend, the number of children served, when, of course, there's no reason to think that all of a sudden fewer children are being born with learning disabilities. That would be a rather astonishing conclusion. So I don't know what those numbers are, but I'm very dismayed to see that we're actually serving fewer children over time rather than more.
Susan in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much. I just wanted to report that my husband and I adopted a blind child in 1997, and at the time we lived in a rural school district that had no money. So our experience when we introduced the staff to our blind child, their first question was, "Do you have any proof that she's blind?" And it kind of went downhill from there. So long story short is that we ended up buying a second house in the city of Delaware so that we could send our daughter to city schools. And that worked out very well. They did a great job of attending to her special needs. And our daughter just finished her freshman year at OSU with a 4.0. So it can be done. But as your guests have pointed out, it's a sojourn. It's an odyssey. The parent has to be completely attentive to everything that's going on. And we were very lucky because both my husband and I are educators, so we didn't let them get away with a lot of stuff. But still, if you don't have those resources, if you can't buy a second house, if you can't hire a lawyer to make the system behave as it's supposed to, you're going to be up a creek.
Hey, Susan, you're an educator, so you're inside the system. Do you empathize at all with what the system has been asked to cope with?
Yes, and for that reason, when the Delaware City Schools did things that we didn't entirely approve of, we were very sympathetic and we would work with them to fix those problems. So, yes, I do get it. And I definitely understand that our child put a financial burden on the system and that because we insisted on sending her to regular public schools rather than the school for the blind, that we burdened the system with that expense. But as you have pointed out, my job as her parent was to do the very best for this child. And that was what I was determined to do.
Okay. Thank you, Susan, for your call.
You bet.
Mm-hmm. We have an email from a listener. They write, "My daughter went through the Grandview school systems. When she was in the second grade, she too was told to use a listening device." Referring back to Ruth Kolker's son, the Grandview school system was exceptional in that they met every demand she needed, including purchasing the listening device as well as speech therapy, IEP needs, and even an occupational therapist. She had one-on-one tutoring and help beyond measure. We were very pleased and grateful to the staff and philosophy of Grandview Heights. We get a little check of approval for Grandview Heights. Some school districts do it better than others. I think it's becoming somewhat cachet. You maybe disagree, Kristen Hildebrandt, that some of the better school districts are starting to step up to the plate and realize, you know, we're going to lose people if we don't start taking care of these issues.
Well, I represent parents throughout the whole state. Mm-hmm. So I see the gamut of the large districts to small rural school districts. And to me, really, there are various reasons why a school does well or doesn't do well. If they are familiar with what the parent is asking for and they have done it before, it's much more likely the parent's going to get it. A lot of my cases, parents are asking for things the school has never done before.
Well, so I asked that earlier. Districts tend to be followers or leaders?
I think, there are some school districts in Ohio that do a really remarkable job. And it really depends on what the parent is asking for and the individual needs of that child. So I've seen some trends. The trend of not having done something before makes it more difficult to get it. Of course, if your child is very high needs and the school staff are not being supported by the administrator, that makes it much more difficult to get the services that the child needs. But, you know, I can't say that there are completely bad districts and completely good districts. It really depends on what the parents are asking for.
Carol in Mansfield, you're on the air with a positive note.
Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Thanks again for your program. I listen to it daily.
Thank you.
I just want parents to know not to give up. We started in the late 60s, early 70s with a severely dyslexic daughter who has gone on and got her PhD from Purdue University. So parents should never give up. They should fight, fight, fight.
All right. Thank you, Carol.
You're welcome.
Take care. Melinda in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Melinda.
Hi, thank you. My daughter is in preschool, and this will actually be her third year on an IEP in preschool. And so our next step will be looking into kindergarten. And we've had a great experience so far, but my concerns are around kindergarten and the whole full-day, half-day thing. It's $300 a month in our school district for full-day. So obviously, if you have multiple therapies and other outreach you're doing, that's not really the best place for me to spend my money. You know, I'd rather spend it on her therapies and other things that we've seen her make significant progress in. And so my concern is what's going to happen with her in kindergarten with that half day and the comparable educational experience that she may or may not be getting for those that get the full day experience. You know, in the whole free aspect, when I heard the summation of the statute, obviously, you know, $300 isn't free. So my concern are how her IEP will impact that and, you know, what she might be missing out on that the full day kids get.
Yeah. Thank you, Melinda. That is a key issue we keep turning back to. It's not free.
It should be. And one thing that this parent is going to experience, which we haven't discussed, is the statute makes a radical shift when you go from preschool, when you go to school age to kindergarten, first grade. In the preschool category, all you have to be is what we call developmentally delayed. When you move to kindergarten, you have to fit one of the statute's 10 or so classifications. And some parents are shocked to find that they've been getting great resources for their kid as a preschooler, and that a lot of these resources will disappear when their child enters kindergarten. So I would just suggest to this parent and other parents in that situation, be sure to read the pamphlet the school district gives you, whose IDA is it, and especially read about the transitioning from preschool to grade school, because it can be a rough time for parents who don't understand how the process changes then.
And real quick, Denise and Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Denise.
Hi. I actually am a teacher for Columbus City Schools, and the problem I run into is I get fourth graders who we have been, you know, where the school has been trying to get the child to qualify for services from kindergarten on up, and the parents will not, absolutely refuse to come in for a meeting. You know, we will say, we will come in at any time. We will pick you up. And how do you get that parent to understand that, you know, okay, you want to help their child? We're not trying to hurt their child. We're not trying to label their child. We're trying to help their child.
Yeah, it's an interesting thanks, Denise, for bringing up that side of the equation. We only have about a minute and a half left. But transportation is a big issue, and they're saying, Denise is saying they do everything they can.
There are so many issues affecting a lot of parents with kids with disabilities, poverty issues. So it can be difficult to get parents to participate in the process. There are some ways they can try to assist by providing transportation, meeting the parent outside of the school building at the parent's house. I've certainly done that before in cases. So, you know, school district does have an obligation to try to get that participation, and they should try some of those methods of assisting those parents.
Yeah. Ruth Kolker, any parting thoughts on that score?
No, but I just wanted to agree with the caller who said that you need to believe in your child. And I think that children sense when people don't believe in them. And we've all, Kristen and I, have seen great outcomes for people who've gotten the assistance they need. And the new edition of my casebook, my co-author is dyslexic, and I couldn't have a better co-author. So I know that people can go on to be outstanding members or participants in our society, irrespective of any challenges they may face. And so it's our job to get them there.
Denise, thank you for your call. We appreciate that. Ruth Kolker, thanks for joining us today. Ruth Kolker is author of Disabled Education, A Critical Analysis of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and also Kristen Hildebrandt. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Kristen Hildebrandt is a senior attorney at Disability Rights Ohio. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.